Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church, and America's most popular self-proclaimed right-wing religious fanatic, homophobic, anti-choice talk show host. Today there's a solar eclipse seen by millions of people on the other side of the globe, a perfect solar eclipse. And what powerful evidence of our creator God. How is it that the moon perfectly covers up the sun? Well, the sun is about 400 times bigger than the moon, and it's about 400 times further away. Thus, we have a beautiful solar eclipse that teaches us so much about the creation that God made. And then also the gravity of the moon. It's the perfect distance from the Earth to pull on our oceans so that we have a life-giving tide which oxygenates the waters so that the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans are not stagnant pools, dead water, but filled with life. Okay, so that's the solar eclipse. In the second half of today's show, Lord willing, we're going to talk about the immigration turmoil in America. Yesterday, we were preempted from talking about immigration when an atheist called in, and I'm going to continue that fascinating debate with this atheist over the morality of the God of the Bible on tomorrow's show, Thursday, when the atheist calls back in. So that'll be fascinating. And in a show coming up soon, we're going to talk about original sin. Some Christians believe that because of original sin, that babies who die, many babies, most babies, go to hell. And the Bible states very clearly, God says he would never, ever punish a child because of the sins of the father. Now, on the issue of abortion breast cancer, if you go on the internet to the web encyclopedia, wikipedia.com, and you look up abortion breast cancer, you'll see that it's a huge controversy and there's a debate. And a professor at Baruch University, at Baruch College, filed a minority report at an event sponsored by the National Cancer Institute. And the minority report argued that abortion is a risk factor when it comes to a woman coming down with breast cancer. And the man who filed that report, Joel Brind, is on the line with us. Professor Brind, welcome to Bob Enyart Live.
Well, good to be here. Thanks.
Joel, could you explain to me and the audience how is it that abortion could be a risk factor in breast cancer?
Well, it actually is very similar to most risk factors for breast cancers that have to do with pregnancy and childbearing. In particular, one of the things that pregnancy has to do is prepare the breasts to be capable of secreting milk. Hmm. Even a sexually mature woman who has mature-sized breasts, if she's never been pregnant before, and even if she has been pregnant before but not nursed in some time, her breasts are not capable of secreting milk. They have to go through a developmental process during the pregnancy. Now, most of the pregnancy, in fact, 32 out of the 40 weeks of pregnancy, comprise the part of the progress of the developmental process, which is for the breasts to grow, for the cells to multiply. And so you have lots of estrogen stimulation going on, much, much higher than it ever is in the non-pregnant state, stimulating her cells to grow. And it's only in the last 8 weeks of pregnancy that other hormones turn these cells into milk-producing cells and turn off their ability to multiply.
Okay.
So it's these cells which are not mature or differentiated to produce milk, which are capable of multiplying and capable of being stimulated by carcinogens to multiply and become cancers. And quite simply, then, there are more places for cancers to start. If a woman has had a pregnancy that's been interrupted by an induced abortion than she had before the pregnancy began.
So let me see if I'm following. Early in pregnancy, there's an increased level of estrogen.
It starts within a few days after conception, that's right.
Okay, does that mean a few days after implantation or fertilization?
No, a few days after fertilization, within 3 or 4 days after fertilization, you can actually detect increased levels of estrogen. In fact, that is usually the first sign that a woman is pregnant. She feels tenderness and swelling in her breast.
Okay. Could we go down that side path for a moment, since the medical community has redefined conception to mean implantation?
Right.
And so we often, when we talk about protecting the life of an unborn child, we're forced to use the word fertilization.
Yes, well, I do mean fertilization.
Okay, but I just want to ask you this question about the biology there. So the woman's body knows that she's pregnant. Estrogen levels are increased even before implantation?
Yes.
And so that the woman's body knows she's pregnant even before now much of the medical community.
Well, yes. The way I would describe it is this way. What happens is the signals are sent from the new child who's just been conceived. In fact, the first sign of pregnancy that is detectable in one of these early pregnancy kits that's also there in very low levels early on before implantation. I mean, you can now tell if you're pregnant before implantation anyway, before the missed period, which is basically before implantation.
Right.
A woman can tell if she's pregnant. She will get a positive sign from a pregnancy test. Now, what that is testing for is what most scientists and doctors will call a hormone, but technically it's not a hormone. It's actually a substance which is like a hormone, but because it is secreted by the embryo, the child, and not the mother's body, it's really a pheromone. And what it is it's a signal to the mother's ovaries to get her uterus ready, because there is a new tenant on the way for his 9-month lease.
Wow.
And what I usually describe this as to my students is that this is really baby's first cry.
Mm.
It is not an audible, but a chemical signal from the child to the mother.
Wow.
Specifically requesting that it be nourished.
Wow, that's really exciting.
And that's all happening before implantation. Otherwise, implantation couldn't happen. The uterus needs to know, the ovaries need to know, and to tell the uterus that the child is on the way. Otherwise, the uterine lining will be shed in a menstrual period.
Well, Dr. Joel Brind, by the way, for the audience, Dr. Brind is professor of biology and endocrinology at Baruch College in New York. That's the first time I've ever heard it described on any talk show that I've heard in all my years, that this brand new living human being actually sends a signal to the mother before that child is even implanted. That's pretty exciting.
Detecting that signal is the basis of every single pregnancy test.
Wow. Okay,
on the market.
Now let's get back to my understanding of what you've described so far. So early in pregnancy, the woman's body, she knows she's pregnant, the estrogen levels are increased, and that starts multiplying cells in her mammary glands.
That's correct, yes.
And those cells,
they have to get a lot bigger before it wouldn't help for a woman's breast to start producing milk early in the pregnancy. Not only the baby doesn't need it, but
right,
there's not enough of the milk producing tissue in there. They have to get a lot bigger in order to be able to make enough milk to feed the baby when it's born.
And so to prepare for lactation, first there's these cells need to multiply.
That's
which
right.
Normally they don't do. And then you said within 8 weeks of the birth or so, that's when they start to differentiate to lactate?
That's when they sort of turn the corner in differentiation, so that they are now less vulnerable to multiplication and less vulnerable to the effects of carcinogens. So in other words, the first 32 weeks of pregnancy is a time during which a woman's risk of breast cancer is increased. And the last 8 weeks are a time when the risk of cancer is decreased. So, for example, in very early pregnancies, very early deliveries, where you have just very premature babies who are delivered 24, 25, 26, 28, 30 weeks, 31
right,
weeks, those women have double the risk of breast cancer. They don't get the protection that you get with a full-term birth.
Now, does
instead, their risk goes up because if the pregnancy is terminated before 32 weeks, it doesn't matter what happens to the child. It matters that that developmental process in the woman's body has been terminated too soon.
So if we set aside the abortion issue, do groups like the American Cancer Society, do they admit when a woman delivers prematurely that her risk for breast cancer increases?
No, not really. The National Cancer Institute says, well, we don't know. That's an epidemiologic gap, they call it, which is nonsense because from the same data, from the same data set in the same population, they're willing to draw the conclusion that there is no connection between abortion and breast cancer. But there's another issue here, too, and that is they do admit that a woman who has a full-term pregnancy has a long-term decrease in her breast cancer risk. That's literally been known for centuries. So whenever a woman has a child, her long-term risk of breast cancer is going to go down afterwards.
Right.
This is known and this is admitted. It is also acknowledged that if a woman aborts that pregnancy, she does not get that protection.
Right.
So, in fact, any reasonable standard of informed consent and patients' rights would state that a woman has to be told that if she is considering an abortion, that if she aborts that pregnancy, her long-term risk of breast cancer will be higher than if she chooses not to abort that pregnancy. But they don't tell her unless there is, as many states have done, passed laws requiring that women be informed that there's an increased risk of breast cancer. But they don't admit this in so many words. It's the fact that a full-term pregnancy protects against breast cancer, lowers the risk. They sort of dissociate from the any connection with abortion.
So
it's hidden. It's acknowledged, but in a hidden way so that women don't really get the benefit of the information.
So the American Cancer Society, they include abortion in a list of risk factors.
No, they don't.
No. Well, if I finish the sentence.
Oh, okay.
They call it an unproven risk factor list, and they have it in that list.
Oh, okay.
Right. So that they're at least admitting that some people are concerned about abortion, but they call it an unproven risk factor list.
Right, but what I was just alluding to a moment ago was that in addition to the fact that there is this controversial increase of breast cancer risk beyond what it would have been if the woman did not get pregnant in the first place,
right,
there is also the incontrovertible fact that if she has an abortion, she has a higher risk of breast cancer than if she does not choose the abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So that should certainly be pointed out to women anyway. There are really two things going on. There's the loss
right.
of the risk decrease from having a child, and then there's an extra increase from having the pregnancy go partway and then be terminated early.
Right. Okay. And I understand that. And that shows, I think, the political bias of the cancer societies, because they're committed to a pro-choice agenda, and so they're willing to withhold this vital information.
Right, yeah, it's what we might call the safe abortion mentality, things that are supposed to be safe. And this goes beyond abortion. This goes to any issue in the public health arena where a procedure or a medicine or anything that is widely held to be safe and which has been used by many years, and which is promoted as safe for the public health, information that shows any lack of safety tends to be suppressed. The same was true, for example, going back to the 1950s. 50 years ago, when the Salk vaccine came out, information that proved that it might have monkey viruses in it, that it might pose long-term dangers, that information was suppressed because vaccinations are supposed to be safe. And, you know, everything has its risk, but there is the whole kind of public policy attitude that if something is promoted as good for the public,
right,
they don't want to admit in any way that it's not. And once something has been in wide public use, such as vaccines or such as abortion, for decades and has subjected millions of people to it, the incentive to admit that maybe, oops, we made a mistake and this isn't so safe after all, is even less.
Well, let me ask you this, play devil's advocate here. Let's say somebody hears your description of why an abortion could increase a risk of breast cancer because of the change that the woman is going through at that stage in her pregnancy. But they say, well, we've had 50 million abortions in America in the last 40 years.
Right.
And there hasn't really been any significant increase in breast cancer among young women.
Well, that's not true. Actually, there has been. In fact, if you go back to the turn of the century here and even to the last decade of the 20th century, where the National Cancer Institute came out with a comprehensive report in 2001, and they showed, for example, in the last decade of the 20th century, a trend which is still continuing, and that is the incidence of cancer is going down. The incidence of cancer in men has gone down 3% a year, and the incidence of cancer in women has actually gone up slightly more than 3% a year. Hmm. So the overall incidence of cancer hasn't really gone down. Why? It's all cancer in women, and you look at that more closely. It's all breast cancer in women, and you look at that statistic more closely, and guess what?
What?
It's all in women who were under the age of 65 in 1998. You do the math. That means women who were under the age of 40 in 1973 when abortion was legalized. So the entire increase in cancer that we're experiencing, all the other major cancers are going down. Lung cancer has been going down. Colon cancer has been going down. Cervical cancer has been going down. Everything's been, all the major cancers that kill most people from cancer have been going down, except breast cancer.
Now,
and only in those women who are young enough to be in that post-Roe v. Wade generation.
So it seems to me that if you consider the biology, there's a powerful argument to be made, not only that there is a link, but why there's a link. When you look at the big picture of the statistics, that breast cancer in young women has increased. It's this major epidemic, and it increases while other cancers are decreasing, and that increase in breast cancer among women are keeping the overall cancer rate steady. It seems like people who care about women's health should be willing to look at this.
Well, should be, yes.
But they're not.
But no, there are all kinds of political forces at work, and we should understand, too, that the climate of scientific research is such that scientists gain wide respect, and people say, well, we should believe this because the National Cancer Institute says so, because the National Institutes of Health says so. And there's a very interesting paper that came out in the middle of last year that was published in the very prominent British journal called Nature. And the title of this paper was called Scientists Behaving Badly. And they found, for example, that 15.5% of scientists who were surveyed anonymously admitted to changing the design, results, or interpretation of studies based on pressure from a funding source, the funding source being the National Institutes of Health.
Yeah.
So,
what a great point. In fact, 2 years ago, they were having the Race for the Cure in Denver, well, all over the country, sponsored by the Komen Foundation, and I got to interview one of the Latina advisors that worked for a Komen Foundation, Eve Sanchez Silver, who resigned because she began reading the studies that showed this extraordinary link between abortion and breast cancer, and not only was the Komen Foundation unwilling to look at those, but they were funding Planned Parenthood, an organization that increases the incident of breast cancer for American women.
Yeah, they're the largest abortion provider in the country, so they obviously have an interest in suppressing anything that would take away their business, that would tarnish their reputation for providing safe services.
Mm-hmm. Could I ask you, do you recommend, there's a website, abortionbreastcancer.com?
Yeah, that's a very good website. That's run by the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer, and it's a very extensive and detailed website. I've contributed a number of things to it, actually. That's not our Breast Cancer Prevention Institute website, which is www.bcpinstitute.org. And ours is more generally about breast cancer prevention and not just abortion and breast cancer. But that is that website you mentioned is run by the Abortion Breast Cancer Coalition, dedicated to that particular issue.
And that's how we actually originally found out about you, and for years, we've encouraged people. In fact, we go to the Race for the Cure every year, people from our church, Denver Bible Church, and hand out a thousand or thousands of flyers urging the women to go to abortionbreastcancer.com. And so your site is
bcpinstitute.org.
Okay. bcpinstitute.org. A couple last questions. Dr. Joel Brind, in Colorado, our legislators are trying to pass an over-the-counter Plan B. That's the morning-after pill. If a woman has had sex and an egg is fertilized, so there's a brand-new living human being, this Plan B will basically abort that baby, and he will not implant, and he'll be killed. And our legislators, so not only is it a bad pill, but they're trying to pass this so it would be available over-the-counter, where the pharmacist looks at the woman or the girl and decides whether or not to sell this drug to her.
Well, let me say a couple of things about that. First of all, about it being an abortifacient, that's actually something that, although the manufacturer claims it can work that way, there's a good deal of doubt that it can actually do that. However, just keeping in mind the effect of the pill on the girl, it would be very interesting to ask some of these legislators how they would feel about making over-the-counter available for high school and middle school athletes these same kinds of synthetic anabolic steroid pills that the athletes are not allowed to take, that they should be over-the-counter rather than banned. Because that's all these are, oral contraceptive pills. We call it the pill. We call the morning-after pill the pill. But these are nothing different than potent synthetic anabolic sex steroid drugs. Mm. They're just the female type instead of the male type. But they still can cause liver cancer and reproductive cancers, and that has been acknowledged by the World Health Organization. So whether or not you believe that they cause an early abortion as a matter of it having to do with the life issue, just a matter of taking a drug that they want to ban outright, even by prescription, for use by any professional athlete, they're ready to hand to our middle school daughters over the counter without a prescription as long as it's the female type. What kind of message are we sending to our daughters?
Right.
Don't you dare go out and take a steroid to enhance your athletic performance, but just take all you want of steroids to enhance your sexual performance.
Yeah, good
That's
point.
That's the message.
In our Senate hearings this month, there was a pharmacist who testified and a woman who recently, you know about, quit the FDA to promote over-the-counter Plan B. And they testified that this is safer than aspirin, and that's why it should be available in this way.
Well, that's very dishonest.
Yeah. Okay, you know. Last thing I wanted to mention. When you mentioned informed consent, and we're at a time in our history where there's some chance that Roe v. Wade could be overturned. And two points, one political and one moral. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, we will have in America hundreds of laws passed by pro-life organizations, literally hundreds of laws, that say you can have an abortion if your parents are aware or if they give consent or if you wait 24 hours or if all these different conditions, if you've been given this information. And these laws are going to come back to hurt the pro-life effort, because now Planned Parenthood will be trying to keep these laws on the books because they're going to keep abortion legal. And the pro-lifers will maybe spend 10 or 20 years trying to repeal their own laws, which they passed in the hope of reducing abortion. And it might end up being the abortion lifeline that keeps abortion legal for decades. That's one.
I don't know. That's an interesting argument. I mean, it's certainly the idea that abortion would not be harmless and that it would not be someone's constitutional right will change the whole landscape, I think. And certainly, there are states in the union which are going to keep abortion fully legal and which are still going to fight tooth and nail from passing any informed consent laws, such as New York State. There will likely for a long, long time be places where abortion is still legal and common.
Well, Dr. Brind, I don't know if you noticed, but during the Samuel Alito hearings, Samuel Alito, in the year 2000, he voted as a federal judge to keep legal partial birth abortion, which is one of the methods of abortion that pro-life organizations, you know, understandably, are so disgusted by. And he voted to keep legal partial birth abortion.
Right.
And which is the equivalent of voting to keep legal the murder of innocent people, innocent children.
Right.
And he was applauded in that decision by many of our national pro-life organizations and leaders. And they said that was a good, right decision. I could give you names,
right,
dates,
right,
organizations. And I think the reason, I think they've confused.
I think what people tend not to understand is the way the judicial system functions. Once the Supreme Court had Roe v. Wade, because that was a decision made by the Supreme Court, then judges who are in lower courts are compelled to go according to that decision. So if he saw in the partial birth abortion ban law that it actually contradicted Roe v. Wade, he was basically duty-bound to say, well, as long as Roe v. Wade is in place, there is no legal basis for upholding the law.
Well, Joel Brin, that's what I mean about pro-lifers becoming confused. There is no justification, whether it's a process or a side deal that men made when they formed a government. There's no justification for any governing official to approve of intentionally killing an innocent child. At Nuremberg, that's what the German judges used as a defense, that it was the supreme judge, the Supreme Court in their land said you can kill Jews, and they said that's why we approved.
Well, it makes for an interesting debate, but I think the music tells us it'll have to wait for
We got to go. Thank you, Joel Brin. God bless you.
It's been my pleasure.
Appreciate that. And for our Iowa audience, you heard the music, but don't fear. That doesn't mean we're going off the air. We got another half hour of the show, and it's going to be great. We're going to talk about immigration. And so if, Joseph, if you're out there, please give us a call, and we'll take your calls and thoughts on the immigration turmoil in America after this. Have you seen the Bob and Yurt Live catalog? It's got so many neat resources, like videos such as Get Out of the Matrix, when I debated a college philosophy class, and Eagle Eggs, when does an eagle become an eagle? Mount Moriah, the evidence for the resurrection, and God and the death penalty. And then there's Video Fruitcake with hilarious liberal callers. So call in and ask for the Bob and Yurt Live catalog, or get it on the web at kgov.com. Of course, all these materials are listed and described on the internet, or call us at 800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. We'd love to send you a Bob and Yurt Live catalog, so give us a ring. That's 1-800-836-9278. 1-800-836-9278. So we're going to talk about immigration. Immigration, that was the promised topic for yesterday in the second half of the show. We never quite got to it. So we have turmoil in our country with 11 million illegal aliens in America. The Minutemen Civil Defense Corps, these are civilians, they're working our border, and they report illegal immigrants to the Border Patrol. And when they do that, they effectively shut down the length of the border when and where they volunteer from illegal immigrants crossing into Mexico or Arizona. Then we have these massive pro-illegal immigration protests of this past week, which I think has taken the average conservative by surprise, that so many Americans would march to support illegal immigration. And so many illegal immigrants, I think it has surprised conservatives that so many illegal immigrants would be so bold as to publicly call for our laws to be defied. I think that's a bit of a surprise also. And consider that every year American citizens pay billions of dollars to care for illegal immigrants, for their families, their health care, for their children's education, for all kinds of taxpayer-subsidized benefits. And then, to add insult to injury, protesters bring Mexican flags waved by the thousands, raising the obvious question of where does their allegiance lie? Their first national allegiance, where does it lie? To America or to Mexico? Now, all of these observations could make Americans upset and even emotional. And so I'm going to ask you to set aside your emotion and think with your mind. Let's address this crisis calmly, biblically, and based upon principles that should govern all nations regarding their borders and their relationship with other countries. I'd like us to discuss a nation's need to secure its borders, a nation's need to control the influx of immigrants, and the Christian's proper attitude and responsibility toward immigrants, and then finally, the proper way to resolve the immigration crisis. That's what I'd like us to talk through. Okay, now on the need to secure our borders, any nation, every nation, if you don't have a border, then you're not a country, right? If you don't have a border, you're not a country. And just as good fences make good neighbors, you put up a good fence and you improve your relationship with your neighbor. Good fences make good neighbors. And the same thing is true with nations. When you have a border that is identifiable and is respected, then you can be good neighbors. And when you don't, if there's a border dispute or a battle, a fight, who has the right to cross this border, when, where, how, then you're asking for tension and conflict. And so if you don't have a border, you're not a country. And you need a national border not only to identify yourself, who you are, we are a country, and here's where our boundaries are, but also to thwart enemies who would infiltrate your country. People who would come in historically, who would that be? Well, that would include an invading army, right? You have an army that wants to attack, and if you have a border they just walk across, then they do. Or maybe it's a spy coming in, or a saboteur. Now, today, we want to defend our borders because they're not only, say, Russian spies coming in, but there are terrorists. Without secure borders, a terrorist can walk into our country and then work from within using our roads, our internet, our libraries, our manufacturers, our rental car companies. They could work from within to build a truck bomb to take down an entire building. So, of course, America needs to secure our borders to prevent infiltration by those intent on hurting us. And by the way, there are Arab groups who see our Mexican border as a real possible way of sneaking into America. So that's the concern on that level. So there are people who want to come here with designs against us. But even though the border should be secure, and then when people come into our country, it should be through border crossings, and they come in an orderly way, governments still have a real need to control the flow of immigrants into their country, even if they're coming in an orderly way. For example, somebody wants to come here, and in Mexico, they're a known drug dealer, or a convicted felon, or a murderer, or they're wanted for the commission of a crime, suspected for a crime somewhere in the world. Well, countries should not allow known criminals into their country, people who have committed serious crimes or who are on the run. So a country wants to know, well, who's coming in? Do you have a criminal record? Are you a suspect? Are you running from the law? And that's a reasonable request of governments, in fact, a demand to know who are you and before we allow you into our country. Then there are also people with highly contagious diseases, that if there is a highly contagious disease or a disease that tends to be lethal, for example, like AIDS, a country might want to quarantine people who have a contagious disease or a lethal disease, and certainly not allow more people with that disease into the country to travel around the globe, which would tend to further spread a disease around the globe. That's another consideration. Which diseases that you'd want to keep out of the country? And then today, there's also Islamic extremists. If somebody is a member in good standing at a mosque run by a blind cleric in London, I'd say we'd probably not want to allow him into the country because it's just simply a risk that we don't need to take. If somebody is an Islamic fundamentalist that celebrates when Jews or Christians or Americans are killed, then that's somebody we'd want to keep out of the country. All right, so governments have a real need and a responsibility to control the flow of immigrants. We need to balance that with our responsibility, right? Governments are run by human beings, and human beings have obligations to do right. And in fact, a government should not murder, shouldn't steal, shouldn't kidnap. Right? Governments should not do those things. Governments should not bear false witness. So the responsibilities that God puts on us as individuals, he also puts on governments. A government leader should not sin. Now, we can't pass laws against all sins. We pass laws against all crimes. So that being angry without cause is not a crime. It's a sin. But murder is a crime. Murder is a sin and a crime. So that if you're envious, envy is not a crime, it's a sin. But if you're envious and you steal from your neighbor, then that is a crime. So governments should outlaw crime and not outlaw all sins, just crimes. But at the same time, governments should honor God, and governing officials should not sin in the way that they uphold laws. All right? So God tells us in Scripture that we are to love God. So a good governing official would love God, and that we are to love our neighbor as ourselves. And a good governing official would love his neighbors, not only the guy who lives in the house across the picket fence, but including nations around the world and other people, and realize that Jesus Christ loves Mexican people, their families, their children, as much as he loves American families and our children, as much as he loves an Arab man or a Jewish man. Right? God made us all from one blood, from Adam, and Christ died for the world. And Jesus said, "If I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me." And it's the will of God that all men might be saved. And Peter says that there is room for all to come to repentance. And that even the false teachers who are enemies of God, that God bought them. Jesus Christ, he shed his blood for the world so that even the false teachers who are enemies of God, they deny the Lord who bought them. All right, so God has a love for all the world. And we as Christians need to not only recognize that, but we need to reflect that in our own attitude toward others. Jesus said the first and greatest command is to love God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength. And the second is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. Why is that? Well, in Genesis chapter 9, God mandated the death penalty. And why? Why kill a convicted murderer? Because God said to Noah that man was made in God's image. So man is made in God's image and his likeness. And therefore, if you kill an innocent person, you should be put to death. That wasn't a maximum crime. That was an absolute requirement that a convicted murderer should be put to death. And it's the same with loving our neighbor. You love your neighbor as yourself. Well, what neighbor? Just certain neighbors? Just my neighbors who are Christian? Just my neighbors who are Americans? Remember the Samaritans? Now, the Samaritans, they were not believers in God. If they were around today, maybe some Protestant would look at, let's say, Mormons and say, okay, Mormons are not true Christians. They're polytheists. They believe in many gods. And they believe that one day, if they're a good Mormon, they'll become God and people will worship them. Now, that's a tragic pagan belief. But that's what Mormons believe. So Mormons are not Christian. They don't believe in the monotheism taught through Scripture and believed by Abraham and written for the world by Moses. They don't believe in monotheism. So anyway, you look at Mormons, you say they're not Christian. Well, back in the time of Jesus, the Samaritans were not followers of God. In fact, Jesus said in John chapter 4 that the Samaritans, they didn't even know who God was. They didn't know who God was. They don't even know what they worship, Jesus said. But when there was someone who was hurting, a man who was beat by criminals, by a gang, and left for dead on the road to Jericho, Jesus said, you know who loved that man? It wasn't the Sunday school teacher. It wasn't the pastor. These guys were too busy with their ministry to care. It was the Samaritan. The Samaritan was the example of someone who loved his neighbor. And so today, it could be that if Jesus were here and trying to tell us the same, get across the same truth, that loving your neighbor is one of the greatest responsibilities of any person, and especially any Christian, he would say, he wouldn't talk about a Christian, he would find a cultist. He'd find a cult. And he'd say, you see that Baptist walking down there? He didn't care that these children were being put to death. Or you see that Lutheran minister over there? He didn't care that there was an X-rated video store in his little town. But you see this cult member right here? He tried to stop the killing of an unborn child, or he tried to stop pornography from flooding his community. That's what it means to love your neighbor. So we Christians so easily get caught up in our doctrine or our theology or our comfortable life that we forget, so easily forget, that what God expects from us is that we would love our neighbor. So while a government has every need and every right and every obligation to secure its borders and to control the flow of immigrants, governments should also have open arms and be welcoming toward those who want to come and visit or come and live and work here. Now, of course, there's a problem. Because in America, we have what? Well, we have a crime epidemic. We have millions of people in jail, right? A couple million people incarcerated every day in America. One way or another, about 2 million people who are in the system. And we have hundreds of billions of dollars we spend on handouts, government handouts, welfare. And these things turn the immigration issue into a true crisis. So we'll take your calls at 1-800-8-NYART. We'll take your calls at 1-800-836-9278. But let me wrap this up in this way. This is what the government should do to deal with immigration. We should first secure the border so that people cannot come in here illegally. Secondly, we should have an orderly process for visitors and those who want to come here permanently. They should be fingerprinted and a DNA sample put into a DNA database to deter crime. We should fix our broken criminal justice system so people coming here know that if they commit a crime, there's a high chance that they will be caught and the punishment will be swift and severe. And then we should do away with welfare. Why? Because welfare violates do not steal. So doing away with welfare is the proper thing to do. But then also, Americans by the millions will not have a systematic reason for doubting the integrity of a Mexican family who's coming to America to work. Because with welfare, people suspect one another. Oh, you're just coming here to live off the work of others. Whereas the Apostle Paul said to the Thessalonians, he said, this is a command. If anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. All right, so those are the solutions to the immigration crisis. And when we realize that the number one demographic for whether someone will become a believer in Jesus Christ is if he lives in America, then we should realize that we should want orderly immigration and welcome people here largely so that we can share the gospel with them right across our backyard fence. Let's go to the phones in Stratford, Iowa. Jacob, welcome to Bob and Yurt Live.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Great, sir.
I had an idea. I totally agree with your statement saying that we need to have an orderly, distinct way of having visitors come in here. I think too many people coming in for different reasons and staying in here. I also think that contrary to popular belief, which is if we ship them all back, send back all the illegals, it will bankrupt our system. I think that if we keep putting this off and keep putting this off, amnesty will be the only solution. And you know what? You have to reap the seeds that you've sown.
Right.
And I mean, we either do it now. You either cut your grass while it's halfway, or your grass is going to get so tall, you're going to have to order a DR trim and brush mower. I mean,
right.
You cut it now when you can, or else it's going to get out of control. And
well,
I think that we need to do something about this now instead of keeping putting this off.
Our government does not respect our laws. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I agree.
Our government, they're the ones who are to enforce the law. From President Bush on down through the vast majority of our governing officials, they don't respect the law. They're only doing something now in Congress because it's such a conservative issue and elections are coming up, but they don't care. They don't respect the law. So to think that foreigners would respect our law when we don't is inane. It's absolutely inane. Like the Bible says, judgment begins with the house of God. So if my church has people living, shacking up together, and we don't disfellowship them, then why am I going to whine about immorality in the society at large?
I don't think you can.
Right. So when our governing leaders don't respect our need to secure our borders, it is silly of conservatives to think that foreigners should respect those laws because they don't. They don't. They won't. It's human nature. So well, let me ask you this, Jacob.
Yeah.
I want to go through. I just made a few points. I want to find out if you. So obviously you agree that a nation should secure its borders.
Correct.
Do you agree that also government should control the flow of immigrants based on if somebody's a suspect to a crime or an Islamic extremist or
Definitely.
Highly contagious disease? You agree with all that?
Definitely. I think that it's essential to the security of the nation.
Okay. Do you agree that when we do allow people to come into the country, that it's wise to ID them, take fingerprints and a DNA record?
Definitely.
Do you agree that it would go a far way to resolving the immigration crisis if we had an effective criminal justice system and if we did away with welfare?
Welfare, I think, is the hugest thing Definitely both of those, but welfare especially is the thing that they're coming over for.
Well, that
now, easy access.
Now, and it's not easy to separate who's really coming here to work hard and who's coming here to live off of somebody else's work.
Well,
it's hard to separate that. You can't systematically separate that. And the only solution to that is to do away with welfare, which is unjust inherently.
Well, let me just say something. I actually lived in Los Angeles for a very long time.
Yeah.
And the Mexicans down there, if you don't know the culture, they are a very, very hardworking people, just in their defense. And I believe that most of their intent is to come over, or was to come over, and do hard work to kind of live the American dream.
Right.
However, I think that they have suddenly found these little loopholes, and they say, hey, free money here, free money here.
Yeah, the welfare, the welfare system,
found a way.
Jacob, the welfare system is seductive to people who have low incomes to start with.
Right.
The reason welfare seduced millions, more percentage-wise, many more blacks than whites is because blacks had lower incomes, so welfare could enable them to continue their standard of living, whereas the same percentage of whites would have had their lives destroyed by welfare if the welfare money was bigger. If they gave you $60,000 a year, if you didn't work, you'd find, you know, a huge percent, half of whites wouldn't work, or more.
Yeah.
So of course, blacks and Hispanics who were at a lower income level would be more seduced by our welfare benefits than whites generally. That's not because they have more inclination toward selfishness or laziness. It's just a matter of economics.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so it sounds like we're in basic agreement, and these are the solutions to our immigration problem.
I think so.
And how about this? Welcoming people to this country because that's the best way to get the gospel into their families is when you live in America, there are churches, Christian radio, TV, Christian bookstores, Christian concerts, unlike anywhere else in the world.
Right. And, you know, I think another thing with immigration, I really think that we should start having mandatory English classes or something. English is
Here. One way to do that, I don't know about mandatory English. I don't think you'd have the right to do that. But the government should not bend over backwards to make all kinds of services available in multiple languages. Because when I travel to another country, I don't expect that they're going to provide me with all the information, everything I need in English. I go there as a visitor, and I try to learn a few phrases I need to get around. And if I respect that culture, I'm going to try to be assimilated into their culture just by respecting them.
Right. Yeah. No, yeah, you're right.
All right. Hey, Jacob, thanks for a great call.
Thank you.
Appreciate you. God bless you and God bless Iowa. Boy, we're so thrilled to be on the Faith and Freedom Network. And our website is kgov.com. So check that out. And we're going to be talking about original sin coming up here soon. That'll be interesting. God bless you.